Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 50 branches worldwide. For more information, visit our website at www.westernfrontassociation.com. Today's episode is number 330, and no, you're not going mad. The last episode was episode 334, and this one had been lurking around, just needing a bit of editorial work and approval to get it broadcast. But we've managed to clear those hurdles, and today, Professor Stephen Badsey gives a lecture on the armistice, especially focusing on the timeline of events from late October 1918 to through the early days of November. This lecture was given by Stephen at the Cork First World War Conference in October 2023. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I was last here in 2015 talking at a similar conference on how the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland got itself involved in the First World War. It seems appropriate to bring this one to an end by the opposite, how the war ended. And it is a delight to be back in this remarkable city again. The vibe is quite extraordinary. The only thing I can compare it to is it's rather like a cold New Orleans. It's got that kind of feel to it. I'll leave you to think about that one. And first of all, I want to pay tribute and thank Jerry White and everybody involved in this conference by the remarkable effort they've put into putting this together. And you've heard in the course of today some excellent papers, and I'm rather hoping you still think so in 45 minutes' time. And what I'm looking at is more or less the period we're in at the moment, from late September, early October, through to the 11th of November, as we head once more towards Remembrance Day in 1918, with two aspects to it as to how the war ended and its relation to the Western Front. Most of you will have an understanding of the last half of the 100 Days campaign on the Western Front, roughly from the breaking of the Hindenburg Line onwards. You'll also have an understanding of the armistice and how the armistice negotiations progressed. What I'm going to do is to bring them together for you, I hope, and show you how they related to each other, what's going on sometimes almost a day-to-day basis. And what you will find is there are occasional periods between late September 1918 and the 11th of November, when events just overwhelm people. There are so many things happening on the Western Front, on other fronts, in politics, that nobody can really cope. And there's another factor that goes with this. I do hope you've all seen that film. It came out last year, the first ever German language version of Erich Remarque's novel All Quiet on the Western Front, In Westen nicht Neues. Or, as I think directors like to put it now, a love letter to Remarque's novel, because it's not a very accurate version of it, and it's massively historically inaccurate. It's a brilliant film. Please watch it. Films do not have to be historically accurate. This one won the Oscar for the best foreign language film. But unfortunately, reflecting, as films always do, the year in which it's made, not necessarily the year in which it's set, it includes aspects of modern German politics which have deeply disturbed German historians in the time of the commemoration, the 100-year commemoration, and one of them is a revival of something which we thought was long dead, the stab in the back myth, the Dolchstoßlegende in Germany, the belief that the German army on the Western Front was undefeated and that Germany lost the war through a collapse in the home front. And that's a caption from the end of the film. At the end of the war in November 1918, the front line had barely moved. Now, you all know that by the 11th of November 1918, the Allies had driven the Germans back on an 80-mile front for a depth of more than 50 miles. This is absolutely untrue, and it is reappearing in German politics particularly, and historiography, which is disturbing. Oh, that photograph, by the way, is often given captioned, although we don't really know, as the last shot fired by the British Army just as 11 o'clock came up on the 11th of November, possibly 109th Battery Royal Field Artillery, taken by the official photographer, Ernest Brooks. But that is the interaction I want to look at, the Western Front and certain aspects of other fronts, with the circumstances that led to the armistice, and how it interconnects with the myth of the undefeated German army on the Western Front. And I think that scene is reasonably familiar to most people. It's a painting, obviously, of the famous modified Wagon-Lit carriage number 2419D at Compiègne Forest, actually the village of Wethon, not far from the River Ain, a railway siding actually built originally for railway guns to fire off. And this is the first meeting of the two ceasefire commissions at about 9 o'clock in the morning on Friday the 8th of November. The negotiations are going to take place over the weekend. Standing up and lower left there is the head of the Allied Commission, of course, Marshal Ferdinand Foch, representing not just the French army or his position as Generalissimo of the forces on the Western Front. Foch is representing for these purposes all the Allied land forces. This is correct in the international law of the time. So there is no reason for a British or an American or a Belgian or an Italian land force representative to be there. Foch will speak for all of them. As I said, this is correct. And similarly, sitting alongside him in the British naval uniform there, that is the First Sea Lord, Sir Roslin Weems, representing all naval aspects. He will speak for the Commission on all naval aspects. Actually, the reason that's a painting, first of all, they didn't let any photographers in. That would have been disturbing to the negotiations. But also, it was quite a bit more crowded than that, with any number of staff and interpreters trying to make things work. And the Allies understand what they're doing. An armistice is not a peace treaty. In international law, it is a state of war with a general ceasefire, which is temporary under certain agreed circumstances. And indeed, the 11th of November armistice had to be renewed three or four times before it was superseded by the Treaty of Versailles in July 1919. And the Allies are there under Foch to debate military circumstances and details. This is a surprise to the head of the German delegation, the man standing there and with the pince-nez just there. That is Matthias Erzberger. He is the Secretary of State for the recently appointed government of Prince Max of Baden. He's a career politician. He spent all the war in Berlin. This is the first time he's even seen the Western Front. He has come from the headquarters of the German General Staff under Marshal Paul von Hindenburg at Spa in eastern Belgium, and this is his first full day in the job. And what he thinks he's there to talk about is a political discussion of the details of ending the war, related in particular to the 14 points, the famous 14 points proposed by President Woodrow Wilson of the United States. So, Erzberger, a civilian where you would expect to see a senior general. And in fact, the person who isn't there is Paul von Hindenburg. He should be the chief of the general staff of the German army, or perhaps he might have sent his representative, his deputy, the first quartermaster general, who is not at this date Erich Ludendorff, by the way. So something is definitely going on. Erzberger heads a delegation of four, representing the Imperial Navy, that is Captain Ernst Vansillo, representing the foreign minister, the other gentleman in civilian clothes, the foreign ministry, that is, Count Alfred von Obenstorf, and there is one representative of the German army, Major General Detloff von Winterfeldt. He is of the general staff, but he is not from Hindenburg's headquarters. The OHL, Oberstheeresleitung, OHL means headquarters, he has again been put in as somebody not directly connected. You may begin to gather that Hindenburg is distancing himself from what's happening in this carriage. There's a lovely story by one of... by one of the British observers. I do hope it's true that General Winterfeldt was wearing in his medal ribbons a French decoration he'd been given earlier in his career, and Foch spotted it and pointed to him and said, "You have my permission not to wear that." As I said, I do hope that's true. But how do we get there? What is going on? How does it relate to the Western Front? That's one of the West Point maps, the very good ones of the Western Front situation, round about the 25th or so of September. We have, this is the Rhine River. Part of the negotiations will be the Allies want bridgeheads across the Rhine marked here. Come back to that as we go. But more importantly, this is the situation roughly of the front line. And the Allies are about to launch four offensives in 4 days. They fall like hammer blows on the Germans and they overwhelm their ability to react. On the 26th of September, the Americans, the AEF under Pershing, starts the Meuse-Argonne offensive, driving almost due north through the Argonne Forest. It's pretty tough countryside. They have to stop, regroup and restart three times in the course of this offensive, which goes all the way up to 11th of November. But by the time it's peaked, they are almost at the Meuse Valley at Sedan. So they've driven deeply into the German formations. That starts, and then the first phase ends on the 4th of October. That is on the 26th. The next day, and I can't stress this enough, all of this is happening at the same time. The British Expeditionary Force, the BEF, 1st and 3rd Army, begin their attack in the middle, the Battle of the Canal du Nord. The day after that, up here in the north, this is Army Group Flanders, the Belgian Army, under the command, of course, of the King of the Belgians, with British 2nd Army taking part, beginning the Battle of Flanders, the liberation of Belgium. It's entirely understandable that the King should be in command of that operation. And the fourth attack, on the 29th of September, the BEF 4th and 3rd Armies renewing the attack in the Battle of the Saint-Quentin Canal, the famous breaching of the Hindenburg Line. And it's not just that the Allies, under Foch's command and with his plan, are delivering one hammer blow after another. I have circled there in green just to make this a bit more easy. Like the Allies on the other side, the Germans are dependent for their supplies, for moving men, for moving ammunition, for moving their heavy artillery, above all, from one position to another, on this long trunk railway. It begins about Strasbourg and carries all the way up. And as I said, I've circled it to give the approximate location. The Allies, as you've heard, are a bit more dependent on lorries with better equipment. They're not as dependent upon rail mobility. The Germans are increasingly and entirely dependent on it and on switching forces from one place to another. And the effect of these attacks is that their logistics system starts to collapse. It starts to gridlock. That rail system starts to develop nose-to-tail blockages clean through, together with the accompanying canal system. Allied observers from the 11th of November onwards speak of miles and miles of railway trucks pinned all the way through. This is Foch's operational plan, and it's quite advanced stuff for 1918. His tout le monde à la bataille, or roughly everybody gets stuck in, of striking one blow after another to dislocate the German supply system and their ability to respond. What this shows is not just that the Allies can break the German defences, it shows that the Germans have no way of countering it. They are increasingly paralysed, unable to move or reinforce their forces. And to quote Ferdinand Foch to Douglas Haig on the 6th of October, "Here is the immediate result of the British Army piercing the Hindenburg Line. The enemy has asked for an armistice." That is exactly what happens. Excuse me. While they're withdrawing, deliberately as a matter of policy, the Germans are carrying out a scorched earth wreckage of French agriculture and industry. This is a French map, so it doesn't show the devastation to Belgium, which was equally severe. The French mark this as the red zone, the zone rouge. If you look at this, these are really the old Western Front battlefields around Verdun, the Somme to Cambrai there, and so leading up. If that continued, it would take us up to the Ypres ridges. So it's not unexpected to see the total devastation, zone complètement dévastée, but the yellow zone, important damage, done in the retreat. It's systematic, it's done under orders. The objective is to cripple the French economy for after the war. No other motive. And the French, therefore, seeing this happen, are very concerned about reparations, about the money being provided. This doesn't often register in English language accounts. This is why the French are so concerned with reparations. The Germans are trying to get a losing draw, so to speak, having been defeated on the Western Front, by devastating the French economy for its aftermath. And that is a face only a mother could love. Of course, General Erich Ludendorff, the first quartermaster general, Hindenburg's deputy, and essentially the man directing not just German military operations, but to some extent the German government by this period, late September, early October 1918. And he is the man whose orders they are carrying out. And it's not just this defeat, evident defeat, with no way of responding to it on the Western Front. At the same time, Ludendorff gets from other fronts even worse news. Germany's allies are collapsing. The Ottoman Empire, at the Battle of Megiddo in what was then called Palestine, begins on the 19th of September. By the 25th, it's clearly a major defeat. This is going to continue on with Allied advances and in Mesopotamia until on the 31st of October, the Ottoman Empire signs the Armistice of Mudros. Mudros is the port of Lemnos, the Greek island, on board HMS Agamemnon. So the Ottoman Empire is being driven out of the war, and by about the 25th, 26th of November, they know that at OHL, Hindenburg's headquarters. What really throws Ludendorff is, same day, remarkably, the Salonika Front, which has been quiet since 1916, has come dramatically to life. Also, an attack launched on the 15th of September starts with a major defeat of the Bulgarian army, and on the 28th of September, General Louis Franchier d'Esperey, commanding the Allied forces, and again, correctly, he negotiates this himself without reference to any other country or to any politician, imposes the Armistice of Salonika on the Bulgarians with the provision that the Allies may advance into any Bulgarian territory. Now, why is this important? Not so much for Bulgaria, although it's bad news. It also cuts major land communications between Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire. But because, with Allied troops in Bulgaria, they can drive forward into occupied Romania, overrun by the Germans and Austro-Hungarians in 1916, which means they can, anytime they want to, take away Germany's only major natural source of oil. And that means that sometime in spring 1919, the German fleet, including its submarines, are going to run out of fuel. And there's absolutely nothing Ludendorff can do about it. And he knows it. And the result, according to some accounts, he suffered some kind of nervous breakdown or fit. There's a bit of debate about this, but on the 29th of September, Ludendorff tells Hindenburg that he's got to tell Kaiser Wilhelm II and the Imperial Chancellor that the army can't guarantee to hold the Western Front for another 24 hours. There must be an immediate ceasefire with the Allied powers. Now, that's premature. It's a realistic assessment, but 24 hours was, I think most people agree, an overreaction. The war is lost, and the idea that it's lost comes from Hindenburg's headquarters, not from Berlin or from any politician. And what you see very rapidly over the next few days is the way in which the German general staff come up with a political plan to avoid responsibility for the defeat. Their plan is essentially to transfer the blame away from themselves to the civilian politicians who've been forming the opposition in Berlin for the duration of the war. And their objective is to preserve the honour of the German army, to preserve really the Prussian senior officer corps, and to preserve the general staff. And in this they are going to succeed. The general staff, although the Treaty of Versailles said it had to be abolished, was kept on thinly disguised as the Truppenamt, the troop office, and resurrected, of course, with Hitler's rise to power. So this political manoeuvre is going to succeed. As Ludendorff puts it on the 1st of October, 2 days later, in a briefing to his staff officers, the Kaiser will have to bring into power, and this is quote, those who we mainly have to thank for things have the things have come to this. And then he adds a German proverb, they must eat the soup that they have cooked for us. The idea is to shift the blame, and this is not a purely cynical manoeuvre. Ludendorff does actually believe this, that he has been betrayed by the opposition politicians. The day before that, the German foreign minister, who is of all things an admiral, Paul von Hintz, put into place at Hindenburg's insistence in July, the Imperial Navy is also involved in this, and with the same motives, forces the resignation of the Chancellor, Chancellor von Hertling, and on the 3rd of October, a new government comes into power, headed by Prince Maximilian of Baden, he's always called Prince Max, appointed Imperial Chancellor with a government of centre, social democrat and liberal parties. OHL repeats that it needs an armistice within 24 hours. And it is this government, the government of Prince Max, of which Matthias Erzberger, the head of the German ceasefire commission, is a member, and he is sent out from that government. That's what he's doing there. He's there to take the blame. And as you said, I can't stress enough, all of this is happening at once in about 4 or 5 days. The Ottoman Empire is collapsing. Bulgaria is collapsing, and they're going to lose their oil supply. They realise they can't hold the Western Front, and it precipitates this political change. And the other half of that strategy, Prince Max's government is part of this, it doesn't come entirely from Hindenburg's OHL, is to ignore the Allies and negotiate instead with the United States. Now, the United States was not a member of the Allies. It never signed up to the Treaty of London of September 1914. The United States was an associate power, and President Wilson was very clear on this. So the political strategy is to open negotiations, bypassing the British and the French, also the Italians, the Belgians, and anyone else they can think of, and deal directly with Wilson on the far side of the Atlantic, opening negotiations on the basis of his famous 14-point speech of the 8th of January 1918, in the belief, first of all, that Wilson is a softer touch, that from the far side of the Atlantic he will have less grip of the politics, and that they will probably get a better settlement out of him, and it will avoid having to deal with the British and the French. That's part of it. Excuse me. Part of it also is that although it appears at one point they've never actually read the 14 points, that this is the right kind of mood music to put out for some kind of controlled, negotiated political position. This is why Erzberger comes to that carriage of Compiègne wanting to discuss political settlements based on the 14 points. This is what he's been briefed to do by Berlin, incorrectly, in fact, in terms of the international law of the time. And that is pretty much where we are for this first move up to about the 3rd of October. One of the reasons for going for Wilson is, again, while all this has been going on the 27th of September, he gives an important policy speech. It's called the Five Particulars Speech, reinforcing the 14 points. And OHL and the new government think they've got a way into it. The way this is done is by what are called at the time diplomatic notes. That via a neutral country, it's usually either the Netherlands or Switzerland, one country, and it starts with Germany with its first diplomatic note on the 4th of October, will send a statement or a proposition. The other one needs 3 or 4 days to translate it, check the translation, work out what its own position is, work out the language and send it back. So these notes bounce back and forward from the 4th of October all the way up to the 5th of November. The last of them is called the Lansing Note, which is the one which agrees details that an armistice will take place. And it's from that 5th of November decision that 3 days later they are meeting at Compiègne. But if the Germans had hoped for an easier ride by appealing to President Wilson, they are mistaken. President Wilson and the American government know exactly what's going on. His personal representative, Colonel Edward House, who at this date is based in Paris, is keeping him very well informed, and he is coordinating this with the British, French and the other governments to make certain that they know what's going on as well. So his replies are increasingly strong and increasingly make clear to the Germans that although he wants his 14 points to be the basis of a political settlement, that the key point for an armistice will be to end the war in such a way that Germany could not possibly renew it. The key date is Wilson's note of the 23rd of October, which his third note demands, this is a quote again, unrestricted power to make the renewal of hostilities on the part of Germany impossible. What Foch is going to do successfully is take away Germany's power to make war in the armistice. And the rest of it, now there are slightly vague references, because this is inevitable, about reduction of armaments and so on. The Americans, along with the British and the French, agree that one of the main factors in the outbreak of the war and its conduct has been something that they rather loosely call Prussian militarism, a state of mind or of culture within Germany, and they want that removed. And in that, they are, again, less successful, but the key point is that they will negotiate with the German government, possibly even with a constitutional monarchy, but not with Kaiser Wilhelm in power. That's the key signal of the note of the 23rd of October, that effectively the Kaiser is going to have to resign, abdicate. And if it couldn't get any worse, that's the 23rd of October. On the 24th of October, the Italians open the Battle of Vittorio Veneto, and by the 4th of November, just a day before the Lansing note, which brings us to a conclusion, Austria-Hungary signs the armistice of Vittorio Veneto and is out of the war also. So Austria-Hungary is down and out of the war before the negotiations for the armistice actually start. Moving on. The war on the Western Front doesn't stop. All this has been digested up to the Lansing note of the 5th of October and the actual meeting, the first meeting, on the 8th of November. On the 8th of October, the British start the Second Battle of Cambrai and the pursuit to the River Selle. And on the 10th of October, as a result of the success here, Haig writes in his diary, "We've got the enemy down. In fact, he's a beaten army." And on the 24th of October, 2 weeks later, Haig, in his diary at least, I wonder what he really said, he writes that he told Foch, "When all is said and done, the British Army has defeated the Germans this year." And if he did, I bet Foch loved that. Okay, so Haig is feeling distinctly confident, still worried about the state of his army. Also, by the way, those of you who know it, the parallels between what's happening here and what happened in autumn 1944 are remarkable. The Allies are starting to outrun their own logistics, in particular the British Army, which is advancing almost due east by this point, and has simply begun to outrun its ability to keep itself supplied. There's an argument by some historians that the British Army, that Haig was a technophobe, and it wasn't using its tanks, its aircraft, its heavier artillery to the fullest advantage. A lot of my students have done a lot of work on this. No, they just couldn't keep up. Increasingly, a desperate German defence of small number of reliable divisions, maybe 2,000 men in the front line for a division, are coped mainly with machine guns and with field artillery to support them, are being tackled by a British army, like all British armies, of course, it's got a lot of other nationalities in it, and it's taking British for granted. Debonnet's French First Army is playing a critical role in this, which again is really down to the infantry supported by the field artillery, because no one else can keep up with the advance, and Haig knows he's going to have to make some kind of halt as winter gets closer. These are all factors. And by the way, just there is an Irish element to this, but you're going to have to wait right to the end, but I would just like to put a good word in. I think you already know this, but the main Irish fighting formations, the 10th Division was, of course, in Palestine, which had done rather well. And as you've heard, the 16th Division is with 5th Army in its advance to Artois, and the 36th is with 2nd Army coming up in the Netherlands. But the 16th had been entirely reorganised, having been very heavily damaged indeed in the spring of 1918, and it now has Scottish, Welsh and English battalions with it. And the 36th, as you again will know, it had already always had from the start a small number of Ulster Catholics in it. But this is a slightly suspect source, but I can't resist it. He's actually a Jesuit chaplain, and I think he might have had a bias. But he reckoned that about 10 to 20% of the Ulster Division by this date were Catholic. And that one is perhaps worth exploring. So, Wilson's critical note of the 23rd, basically saying the Kaiser's got to go. In a remarkable manoeuvre, that's Paul von Hindenburg with Eric Ludendorff, of course. The following day, Hindenburg issues an order of the day rejecting Wilson's note in the name of the German army. Not the German government, not the German people, the German army. That's the extent to which we have this split in politics in Germany at this point. And Hindenburg and Ludendorff try a manoeuvre that has worked before in the past. 2 days later, in an interview with the Kaiser, a meeting, they both tell the Kaiser, and this has worked before, the Chancellor will have to resign. This is outrageous. Otherwise, they will both resign. And they had forced the resignation of chancellors. They had forced the resignation I've described of a foreign secretary before. This time it failed. Wilhelm II showed backbone for one of the few times in the war. He accepted Ludendorff's resignation, but refused Hindenburg's. And Hindenburg let it go. Ludendorff was absolutely furious with Hindenburg. He said he would never speak to him again. I think they exchanged words later on. But the Hindenburg-Ludendorff axis is now broken. Ludendorff's replacement as Hindenburg's first quartermaster general is General Wilhelm Groner. And he's not a Prussian, he's a Württemberger. And like Ludendorff, he's not a von. He isn't an aristocrat. Because no Prussian aristocrat would want the job he's got to do for the next few weeks. So Groner takes over as Hindenburg's mouthpiece and deputy as a result of this, and they faced down, the Kaiser has faced down Hindenburg and Ludendorff's threat. Prince Max's response, which is essentially to accept the American position that the war is lost and they're just going to have to do something about it, will continue. The result of this is that Prince Max's government has been working on this already. By the 28th of October, they present a new German constitution, a draft constitution, which is a move to something much closer to a constitutional monarchy in the hope that that will be acceptable. Again, I can't stress enough all of this, why the Allies are continuing to advance into Flanders, up to the Selle, the Americans driving through the Argonne Forest. And in what I think is a rather touching moment, on the 28th of October, the Kaiser calls all his six sons together, and he doesn't ask them to take an oath. He asks them each to shake his hand and tell him that as long as he's alive, they will not accept the throne under any circumstances, with a handshake. And all six of them do it. The following day, 29th of October, the last day Kaiser Wilhelm will spend on German soil, although he doesn't know it yet, he sets off for Hindenburg's headquarters in eastern Belgium at Spa, to be with, as he sees it, his army, where he proceeds for the last few days of the war to make a thorough nuisance of himself. He is, after all, the Kaiser, and at several points he suggests he will put himself at the head of his army and march to Berlin to restore order and his own status. And this is getting increasingly like fantasy, and everybody, I think, knows it. But the sequence is that it is the defeat on the Western Front that precipitates this political crisis, which is going to lead to the collapse of the home front. The Doxdoxlender, the stab in the back myth, has it the wrong way round. It isn't that there's a crisis and a collapse of the home front which causes the defeat. It's the fact that they cannot stabilise the Western Front, and the rest of the war is also turning sour. But it doesn't actually happen through the German army. It happens through the Imperial Navy, which has got a very similar agenda, that it too wants to preserve its own honour, very important to Germans in this context, and it wants to do something. The submarines have been active, but the High Seas Fleet had not lived up to its name. Jutland had been, as you've heard, a sort of winning draw, but they had not achieved any great naval victories. That the only way of maintaining some kind of basis for a continued navy after the war was to establish a burning legend. And it's actually Admiral Franz von Hipper who comes up with this on the 24th of October. The Flotte Verhoeven, my apologies for my pronunciation, the charge of the fleet, it's known as, I've always thought that should be Flotenschloss. I can't quite work out why they called it that, but never mind. Not my problem. You're going to love this one. The entire High Seas fleet, with all its battleships, will sortie into the North Sea, into the English Channel. Some versions have it actually coming up the Thames, where it will confront the overwhelming superiority of the British Grand Fleet with its supporting American battleship squadron, and they will all be sunk. And it will be glorious. This will be a glorious, magnificent defeat. My apologies to the gentleman who read that wonderful poem about Ramilly, but Marlborough won that battle. You should know all about how to rescue moral victories from complete defeat. Just a point there. This is what they've got in mind. They're trying... That's the plan for the charge of the fleet. So the German fleet will go down gloriously. And while all of this is going on again, up to the 29th of October, this leaks to the sailors. And they are not massively keen on dying gloriously. Instead, what we get is a series of mutinies in the High Seas fleet. It starts off in Wilhelmshaven, it spreads to Kiel, it continues on to Lübeck by the 5th of November, Bremen by the 6th of November. Really, they're setting up soldiers, sailors and workers' councils. But, okay, people are dying, bullets are being fired in the street, but compared to the Russian Revolution, or even the French Revolution of 1789, it's a surprisingly subdued process. Germany has lost the war, the German government is collapsing, the Kaiser has fled from Germany, everybody knows this. It's gradually coming to an end with a certain amount of relief. And while that political crisis is happening in Germany, Foch brings together, on the 25th of October, his Allied commanders, Pétain for the French forces, Haig for the British forces, and Pershing for the American forces, at Senlis, which is just north of Paris, to hammer out what they're going to take to their governments as how a military armistice is going to work, what they need, what they're going to do, to agree on their own position. And on the 29th of October, this transfers to Paris, starting with Colonel Howze's own home, is where the first meetings take place. Lloyd George comes over, they meet with the French government and other representatives, and they basically sign off on Foch's position. So when Foch gets into that railway carriage, he knows exactly what he's going to say, and he has the full support of the Allies and the Americans for what he's going to say. It's rather nicely done. As I've described, the critical note, the Lansing note, is the 5th of October, effectively agreeing that an armistice will take place. Again, accompanied by continued fighting, the Meuse-Argonne offensive resumes for the Americans on the 28th of October. By the way, the person who doesn't want this to happen is Pershing, commanding the American Expeditionary Force. He sends a message to Washington on the 30th of October saying he doesn't want an armistice, he wants to keep fighting, preferably to Berlin. And there's a certain amount of discussion before he gets reminded that the president is commander-in-chief. This is the beginning of a series of military-civilian disputes going past the Second World War, all the way up, of course, to General MacArthur in the Korean War, and it doesn't really stop there. And in the last of the great British offensives on the 4th of November, the crossing of the River Sambre, on the 4th of November, the British poet Wilfred Owen is killed in action crossing the Sambre-Oise Canal. So fighting is going to carry on all the way up to the 11th. But this is the situation. That's what the armistice site looked like in 1918. This is the French coaches. They're ready. They actually arrive in position on the 6th because the Lansing note effectively grants permission for this. And, of course, they have to communicate with the Germans to tell them that their delegation will get safe conduct. It leaves from Hindenburg's headquarters, from Spa, but it has to do so by road, coming to the German front lines. They then get out of their cars, transfer to a French train that takes them the rest of the way. That is the French train there. And I was fascinated by this. Of course, Germany had been unified by the defeat of the French in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 to 71, where the Emperor Louis Napoleon lost his throne, otherwise known as Napoleon III. He had died in exile in Britain, was broken-hearted a few years later, but his empress, the Empress Eugenie, was still alive. She lived until 1920 and lived not far from Farnham in southern England. And that is originally the Empress Eugenie's train. And I've always wondered if that was deliberate, but I can't pin it down. Maybe not. It's just perhaps a curiosity and just the way it happened. I'd also like to know what she thought about it, but she was quite elderly, so perhaps nothing at all. It takes, due to the various complications of achieving this, longer than anybody thinks to get the German delegation in that train to that position. It doesn't actually arrive until 7 o'clock in the morning, local time, of course, on the 8th of November. And it's 2 hours later, I showed you the painting of that, that the first meeting takes place, with a certain amount of diplomatic correct needling and to and froing. Erzberger starts with, he's come to hear the armistice terms. Foch just blows it back at him, I have no armistice terms. Pause. Do you ask for an armistice? Yes, all right. It's establishing the precedence. It's correct legal procedure. And as I've said, Erzberger tries to raise the 14 points, and he calls, allegedly on humanitarian grounds, for an immediate ceasefire from that instant to prevent further bloodshed, or alternatively to prevent the German army falling apart, which it's very close to doing, and for an end of the Allied naval blockade. And Foch quite rightly says that's nothing to do with him, so no. And the blockade, if you don't know, remains in force all the way up to the signing of the Treaty of Versailles. It's one of the very few pressure points that the Allies can bring against the Germans during the negotiation, and it's very controversial. The German accounts are full of the number of German children who died of starvation between November 1918 and July 1919. Extremely controversial at the time, it remains so. Talk about that if you like, but they're going to continue. And Foch's terms are, apart from the fact they want the German army to evacuate not just occupied France and occupied Belgium, but the whole of Germany up to the Rhine and allow the Allies those bridgeheads over the Rhine, just in case fighting should incredibly start up, but he's going to make certain they don't. He's going to take away their ability to make war. Hand over 2,000 aircraft, 5,000 artillery pieces, 30,000 machine guns, and get this, 5,000 railway engines and 150,000 rail wagons and 10,000 lorries. That's a critical point, actually. It's not the heavy artillery. It's they won't be able to move or supply themselves. And Roslyn Weems is the first Sea Lord. He had never had his Trafalgar, as the British would put it, in the course of this war, and he regarded these negotiations as his Trafalgar. The Germans will hand over 10 battleships, 6 battlecruisers, 8 light cruisers, 50 destroyers, and 160 submarines. I should say that in the course of the next few days, the Germans try and finesse this by saying we don't have 160 submarines, and Weems, in the last negotiations on the 11th of November, gets fed up and says, fine, we'll make it all submarines. Again, just the techniques of these things. Now, if you ever want to read the actual armistice document, it's a massive great document, it's available on the internet, but it wasn't practical for the Germans to try and encode it and transmit it. A secure transmission, of course, they were allowed that for diplomatic reasons, from where they were. So on the afternoon of the 8th, a staff officer, his name was Captain Heldorf, had to set off in his car and drive the 200 miles back to Hindenburg's headquarters at Spa to deliver a physical copy of the armistice. It's said that he left in tears, and I really can't blame him. And after that, although there's a number of diplomatic exchanges, there's really nothing for the two armistice commissions to do. That is the main event. And there are a couple of meetings at junior officer level to discuss details and technicalities. But until they have the response of the German government as they see it, and, although they're less aware of this, of Hindenburg's headquarters to these armistice proposals, the German armistice commissioners can't move forward. So for the 9th and the 10th, Saturday and Sunday, there's really nothing very much for them to do. And the events of the 9th are critical because the revolution reaches Berlin. There is rioting and rebellion, and the government of Prince Max finally resigns. Ludendorff was in Berlin that day. I haven't really been following what happened to him. Some people have. But he then fled the country to Sweden, and sat down to write his memoirs. If he'd been a private soldier, he'd have been shot for desertion, very appropriate given the previous paper. Early afternoon, it's about 12 o'clock, in fact, through radio telegraph, no speech radio transmission, of course, the information reaches Spahr that the Kaiser has abdicated, which is news to him. Prince Max has resigned, and a new German government is proclaimed, a provisional government under Friedrich Ebert of the Social Democratic Party, which technically means that the German delegation at Compiègne haven't got a government to report to, but everybody pastes over that as rapidly as possible. They do not want this interfered with, so it just picks up and carries on. But the Kaiser's response is obviously difficult. Effectively, in the afternoon of the 9th, Hindenburg gathers together as many of his senior officers as he can at Spahr. Gruner is leading it, of course, as his deputy. Army commanders, there's an army group commander there, even down to some colonels, and has a discussion, and there isn't a vote in the sense that they're counting, but the question we're asking is do you, in your opinion, will your troops continue to follow the Kaiser? And the answer is no. Regretfully no, these are German professional senior staff officers, but they have concluded too that their men simply will not follow the Kaiser. The army will mutiny and collapse. It's over. And at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, in a very uncomfortable interview, Groener has to tell the Kaiser this, with Hindenburg sitting rather uncomfortably again in a corner, trying to pretend he's not there. And the Kaiser, again rather touchingly, demands that Groener puts this in writing, which he does. The Kaiser then leaves headquarters Spahr, initially with an idea of heading back to Berlin, but it's pointed out to him he might actually get captured by revolutionaries, at which point he makes a left turn and crosses the frontier into the Netherlands, where he is given sanctuary in the Netherlands as a respected former head of state. He lives, incidentally, until 1941. When the Germans occupy the Netherlands in 1940, they put an honour guard on his place of residence, but otherwise he does not get involved in that. So there's a new German government which proceeds to negotiate, or try to negotiate, the armistice settlement. And critical to this is, it is, I believe, a phone call. It's hard to be certain because they are so circumspect about this. Between the new head of the provisional government, Friedrich Ebert, in Berlin, and Groener, Hindenburg's representative, in Spahr, on the evening of Sunday the 10th, in which they come to a deal. And the deal is that Hindenburg agrees the German army will support the new provisional government, including the army will support them with armed force, because there's a threat from the east, from the Russians and, for all they know, the Poles, and there's great internal disruption. So the army will do that, and in return, he must support the army. He must allow it to continue. He must allow the power of the general staff to continue. He must accept the stab in the back myth that the army was undefeated. And this is exactly what happens. On the 10th of December, almost exactly a month later, there is a massive parade of the German army through Berlin, and the new chancellor, the head of the government, Ebert, gives a major speech opening, "Welcome, comrades, no enemy has defeated you." That is the price of the preservation of what has become the Weimar Republic. And these are examples from the 1920s. As you can see, the far one is a reprint of a book. Im Feld unbesiegt, Undefeated in the Field, a series of popular memoirs which appeared in the 1920s. And that is the badge of a veterans association. Zürsee im Feld unbesiegt, Undefeated on sea and on land. This is policy of German governments of the Weimar period, right the way through, and it continues to be policy of the Nazi government. And that is how the German government survives into 1919, 1920, and so on, by this deal whereby the stab in the back myth becomes part of their policy. Now, they're all waiting for responses. At 6:30 on the evening of Sunday the 10th of November, Foch sends a gentle little note to Erzberger reminding him that the deadline for the completion of the armistice is 11 o'clock on the 11th of November. They are working up to a deadline, and it's now 6:30 in the evening on the 10th. And they reply that they haven't received a response from the Chancellor. They're waiting for two, one from Ebb as the Chancellor, but they're also waiting for a response from Hindenburg. And these come through over the telegraph in the course of the evening. They're very long cipher telegrams. They take a lot of time to decode and then absorb, but they both say more or less the same thing, telling Erzberger to accept the terms and, in Hindenburg's case, get as good a deal as you can. But yes, really accept them. It is Hindenburg's voice that is critical here, and it is, in fact, the German army and its professional head who are responsible. But it simply takes them a lot of time to decipher all this. And the result of that, it's 2:15 in the morning, and they're really on a deadline, on the 11th of November, that the meeting reconvenes in Foch's carriage. And they've got their agreement from the critical people, the Chancellor, but also the Chief of the General Staff. And Foch can afford to be magnanimous. There are small adjustments. This is no time to fight over it. 2,000 aircraft goes down to 1,700, 30,000 machine guns reduced to 25,000, and so on. It's just Wien's little touch about all submarines that is perhaps excessive. They reach an agreement, and it is signed at 12 minutes past five on the 11th of November. And it's that page on the right there. I think you may just be able to see the signatures of Foch and Weems, and that's Erzberger with his three other delegates signing on that side. It's 12 minutes past five. They back-timed it to be officially signed at 5 o'clock. And they were working so hard because of the small adjustments that had been made that when they signed that page, the rest of the armistice document hadn't been typed out. So they're signing an end page for a document that theoretically doesn't exist and nobody cares because they're ending the war. It takes a while for this to happen. The German delegation then returns to its train, and at about shortly after that, it is about 6 o'clock in the morning, but the conductor in charge, the train commandant, produces a bottle of port and some biscuits, and the Allies drink a toast. I don't know what they drank to, but it's just one of these. And then outside, it's a very famous photograph. This is a colourised version, Foch there with his delegation, and you can actually see the number of the train. But it's light in that photograph. It was actually at 6:20 that Foch and Weems left for Paris to deliver the terms of the armistice to the French government and so on through to the rest. And the Germans left shortly afterwards, actually again for Paris, because the diplomacy was now starting and their delegation had to be in Paris to make it work. Now, we know a great deal about Douglas Haig's day because he was careful to document it. At about 5 o'clock when this was signed, he was in his headquarters train at Iwi, just north of Cambrai. Haig was more mobile than people realise, and possibly he was asleep. At 6:50, having been agreed and signed off at shortly after 5 o'clock, 5:12, the armistice message was logged at Haig's main GHQ at Montreuil, and immediately a staff officer sent out a pre-prepared message. Hostilities will cease from 1100 today, November the 11th, and then it goes on into short detail. The point is, it's done so continuously. Everybody is waiting for this, and it goes out immediately. The problem is getting it out to everybody before the 11 o'clock in the morning. There are all kinds of stories that the Americans in particular either were very inefficient with their radios or Pershing was dropping hints, because there are any number of stories of a certain amount of fighting going on after 11 on the American side. As with so many stories about the First World War, I am neutral on these. I just don't quite know what to make of them. But everybody was trying to get these messages out. For 11, Haig called a conference of his army commanders in Cambrai Town Hall, and afterwards, as you can see, the official photographer took a photograph and the cinema photographer recorded them on the steps of Cambrai Town Hall. He then went back to his headquarters train. And Haig had obviously thought very deeply about this. What was he going to write in his diary? And he wrote this: "If the war had gone against us, no doubt our king would have had to go, and probably our army would have become insubordinate like the German army." And then he refers to a story of the British writer John Bunyan remarking on seeing a man on his way to be hanged: "But for the grace of God, John Bunyan would have been in that man's place. Not quite the end, if I have enough time. I think I do. The reaction of ordinary soldiers was very largely relief. They began to come to terms with the idea that they might actually survive the war. There wasn't really a lot to celebrate with. You could light another cigarette or make a cup of tea, but otherwise it was just a recognition, a rather growing recognition, that the war on the Western Front had ended, but not entirely. In another controversial decision, the commander of the Canadian Corps, Lieutenant General Sir Arthur Currie, it was controversial at the time, it remains so, decided it would be a nice symmetry if the Canadian Corps captured Mons on the last day of the war, just to round the war off in a tidy manner. And the last casualties were taken, in fact, doing this, buried not far from Mons. Some of you have been here at Saint-Symphorien Military Cemetery. The last Canadian soldier to die in the battle, Private George Price of the 28th Battalion, killed by a German bullet just outside Mons, only a few minutes before the armistice was signed. The last British soldier to die, believed to be this man, a 40-year-old private regular soldier, George Ellison, of the 5th Royal Irish Lancers, a couple of hours earlier, about 9:30. And the last Irish soldier to die is disputed. And I could cite a number of cases. I want to cite the one which is most often given. He was a fellow member of the 5th Royal Irish Lancers. His name was Private Thomas Farrell. He was from Lucan. He was fatally wounded just outside Mons on the 10th of November. He was taken back to a casualty clearing station across the French frontier at Valenciennes. He actually hung on through Armistice Day, and he died on the 12th of November, which is why it's controversial. Was he actually a casualty of the last day? He's in Valenciennes Communal Cemetery, Saint-Roch, not far away. And again, I could cite many anecdotes, but I think I've probably run out of my time. I'd just like to offer two of reactions of soldiers, which I find particularly relevant. One is a man called Lieutenant John Nettleton. He was English, 2nd Rifle Brigade, and his leave had run out, and he was about to get on the train at Victoria Station to go back to France. The 11th of November was his birthday. And he writes, "I got on the leave train at Victoria to go back to France and realised it was just another railway journey." And I'm less certain of the factual accuracy of this last one, but you'll see why I want to tell it to you. The last man, by the way, the last British soldier killed as a result of the 11th of November wasn't in France at all. He was probably a celebrating soldier in Blackpool who was run over by a drunken taxi driver at 8:45 at night. But as I said, you're always going to get strange cases. But around about the same time, far behind the front now, at the Tank Corps headquarters at Erin, in their huts, a certain amount of celebration involving, dare I say it, a certain amount of alcohol took place, and two privates got into a violent fight during which one of them pulled a revolver and they had to be physically restrained. One of them was an Ulsterman, and one of them, I'm not sure, but I think he was a Kerry man. He was certainly from the South. And what they were arguing over was whether the North or the South had done more to win the war. But that's the story of Ireland and the armistice, which I think is a story for another day. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.